loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we go to Korea. After continuing big military drills and war exercises between the United States and South Korea, with more than 100 planes, including B-52 bombers on its border, North Korea has announced the postponement of inter-Korean meetings between officials from North and South. North Korea is also saying to the Trump administration, think carefully about your calculations and your words and actions in the run-up to the planned Singapore summit on June 12 between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. And then in our second half hour, we go to our regular Wednesday segment called Beyond Nuclear with Kevin Camps. Kevin Camps is the radioactive waste watchdog at Beyond Nuclear. We discuss harmful nuclear waste dumps that are on the horizon. We talk about nuclear weapons, nuclear waste, nuclear energy, and we'll talk to him about the work that he's conducted in the recent months in New Mexico.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, Israel's killing of unarmed Palestinians has finally caught the attention of international organizations as the diplomatic fallout over deadly violence in Gaza gathers steam. Countries around the world have condemned the Israeli response to Palestinian demonstrations, and that criticism has moved into the United Nations. Next, the Senate Intelligence Committee today voted 10-5 to send the nomination of Gina Haspel to be CIA director to the floor for a final vote. All 8 Republicans and 2 Democrats voted yes on Haspel, who now has enough votes to guarantee confirmation. That final vote will likely take place in the next 48 hours. Then, testimony from the Senate Judiciary Committee regarding the Trump Tower meeting between Trump campaign officials and lawyer Natalia Veselnitskaya was released today. We'll take a look behind the headlines and discuss the real story. And then, primary elections were held yesterday in Pennsylvania, Oregon, and Nebraska, with women and progressives coming out on top in the Democratic Party and mainstream Republicans winning most of their nomination races. Pennsylvania was the most closely watched state. It saw 3 women win congressional nominations in districts that are likely to flip from red to blue. And Richard Saccone, who lost a closely watched race last month to Democrat Connor Lamb in southwestern Pennsylvania, lost again, this time to a mainstream Republican and veteran. And finally, the United States is pushing for a deal in negotiations on a revised North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. But Canadian and Mexican officials were not even scheduled to arrive in Washington before tomorrow's deadline. And without an agreement in writing, Congress can't begin to debate it in advance of passage. And in other headlines, EPA head Scott Pruitt testified before the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee today to defend his controversial tenure as leader of the agency. Senators sharply criticized Pruitt over extravagant spending on travel and office amenities, as well as his discount deal on a condo rental from an energy industry lobbyist. Since taking office, Pruitt has worked to repeal key pieces of environmental regulations. Felix Ehrat, general counsel of the pharmaceutical corporation Novartis, resigned today over payments made to Donald Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen. Cohen was paid a total of $1.2 million by Novartis in what is alleged to be an effort to peddle influence with the new administration. Ehrat said in a statement, quote, "Although the contract was legally in order, it was an error. As a co-signatory with our former CEO, I take personal responsibility to bring the public debate on this matter to an end," unquote. Vote counting in parts of the Iraqi city of Kirkuk was halted today due to an attack by unidentified gunmen. The head of the country's election commission said that the employees at the targeted voting stations were being held hostage. Kirkuk is a hotly contested city that was captured by Kurdish forces following the ISIS offensive across Iraq in 2014, but was recaptured by Iraqi government forces after a controversial independence referendum held by the Kurdistan Regional Government. Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega started talks with the opposition today after 50 people were killed in protests. The protests began when Ortega announced pension reforms that defied the recommendations of the International Monetary Fund but still required an increase in payroll contributions. The government has accused the protesters of being primarily interested in regime change, but nonetheless has agreed to negotiations. Those are today's headlines. Next up is a conversation about Korea. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
But first, we turn to Korea. Following large-scale U.S.-South Korean military exercises and threatening statements from National Security Advisor John Bolton, North Korea has announced the postponement of inter-Korean meetings between officials from North and South. Will the peace process still move forward? We're joined from Philadelphia by Hyun Lee. Hyun is a member of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea, and she is a writer for zoominkorea.org. And we're joined from Santa Cruz, California by Dr. Christine Hong. She is an associate professor of critical race and ethnic studies at UC Santa Cruz and a member of the Korea Policy Institute. Christine and Hyun, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thanks for having us.
I was mentioning to both of you and to John, I passed by the CNN screen outside of our studio about 2 hours right before Donald Trump was expected to speak. And the headline was, Trump to speak about North Korea threat. And it's so typical of what's going on in the media. North Korea feels threatened. They say the military joint exercises going on using B-52 bombers certainly violates the spirit and the letter of the Panmunjom Declaration between North and South Korea. And also, they have many things to complain about how the U.S. is handling this period prior to the scheduled June 12th summit in Singapore between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. Anyway, Christine Hong, let's start with you. Were you surprised by what's happened in the last 24 hours?
I'm prepared for surprises all the way down this road. And so, you know, I would just say that, you know, North Korea, you know, this is being portrayed as North Korea being erratic. In fact, this is North Korea being consistent. In the Panmunjom, the much celebrated joint declaration between the two leaders of the Koreas, they agreed as a basic foundational principle that both North and South Korea would, and this is the language of the declaration, they agreed to completely cease all hostile acts against each other in every domain, including land, air, and sea. And these war games, Max Thunder, completely violate the spirit of this. And so North Korea is simply being consistent in stating that basically the fact that the United States is presenting these very provocative war exercises is business as usual. In fact, this is not a time where business as usual, which actually meant U.S. regime change policies against North Korea, this is not a time when that is an appropriate stance to make. There has to be some kind of good faith gesture on the part of the United States and some kind of fortitude on the part of South Korea in actually making the prospect of peace tangible.
Yeah. Hyun Lee, I'm looking at the Panmunjom Declaration. This is signed following the meeting of Kim Jong-un and Moon Jae-in April 27th at the DMZ. And I'm looking at clause number two, point number one. It says, South and North Korea agreed to completely cease all hostile acts against each other in every domain, just as Christine mentioned, including land, air, and sea, that are the source of military tension and conflict. So obviously, the war exercises, Max Thunder, very large military exercises, are in violation of the letter and the spirit of the Panmunjom Declaration. Were you surprised? Because in some ways, the fact that the war exercises were proceeding was not a surprise because they hadn't been canceled.
Sure. But I completely agree with Christine Hong. I mean, it's been less than a month since the declaration was signed, and they decide to carry out this exercise. That's a 2 weeks exercise. It started last Friday. It involves 100 warplanes, including 8 F-22 fighters and B-52 bombers that are designed to drop nuclear bombs. I mean, it was clear from Kim Kye-gwan, who is the first vice minister of North Korea's foreign affairs, his statement yesterday that this is what they're objecting to. He said, quote, "We have made clear on several occasions that preconditions for denuclearization is to put an end to anti-DPRK hostile policy and nuclear threats and blackmail of the United States." And, you know, as Christina has pointed out, North Korea has taken major steps to ensure a successful summit between Trump and Kim. They released three U.S. citizens who had been detained there. They're now getting ready to dismantle their nuclear test site in Punggye-ri. And, you know, Washington pundits and the U.S. corporate media, they're always quick to say that North Korea should not be trusted. But really, I mean, when we look at the current situation, which is the party that is harder to trust? It is completely disingenuous to talk about peace on the one hand while you're carrying out nuclear strike exercises at the same time. I mean, you know, it was John Bolton who went on CBS a few weeks ago, and he talked about Libya as the model for denuclearizing North Korea. And that, I mean, when I heard it, it was like akin to a death threat to the man you're about to have a summit with. I mean, we should just say that publicly, U.S. and South Korean officials have said that the Max Thunder exercises will continue as planned. However, the South Korean defense minister and the commander of the U.S. forces in Korea just held an emergency meeting, and it seems like they have decided to pull the B-52s out of the exercises. But I think North Korea's threat to, quote-unquote, threat to pull out of the upcoming summit is in effect a wake-up call, basically saying you can't talk about peace while you're continuing your usual, you know, quote-unquote, maximum pressure business.
Christine, I wanted to ask you a question. As only a casual observer of these Korean issues, I've noticed real differences between this new, perhaps temporary opening to North Korea and what Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger did with the Chinese in the 1970s. Most of those preliminary negotiations were behind closed doors. The American public had no idea that they were taking place until there was an agreement to meet in place. In this case, we have Donald Trump tweeting about it every day. We have Mike Pompeo making very high profile trips to here, there, and the other place. We have John Bolton, I agree with you, essentially making a death threat against the North Korean leadership. So who is it that's trying to kill this summit? Is it John Bolton? Is it General Mattis? Because ultimately, he's the one with the authority to order these military exercises. Who is it that's fighting the president and the secretary of state to try to kill this agreement?
You know, I don't have an easy answer to that other than to state that the very structure of the U.S. military-industrial complex militates against the prospect of peace. As many people have noted, North Korea, throughout the post-Cold War, the so-called post-Cold War era, has furnished a necessary pretext for the proliferation of the military-industrial complex. It's basically consolidated, even in the wake of the Cold War, when people thought that finally there would be a kind of spirit of reconciliation and peace that would come to the Asia-Pacific region, the place where U.S. wars turned hot during the Cold War. People expected that a peace regime would ensue. But the U.S. military-industrial complex very cynically mobilized the pretext of a so-called North Korea threat to maintain a forward-deployed posture within the region. And so as much as Trump likes to crow that his policy in all areas is all but Obama, in point of fact, Obama's hardline policy toward the entire Asia-Pacific region, which went under the name of the pivot policy, that policy was very much in line with the interests of the military-industrial complex. And so the question that we have right now is whether or not someone like Trump, who seems to have an ego investment in the prospect of some sort of peace that he can brand with his name, the question is whether someone who is actually threatening genocide against the Koreans, who actually has a businessman's approach to the military-industrial complex, whose America First policy is actually aimed at defunding social programs in the United States and beefing up the U.S. war budget, is it possible that this person, surrounded by a cabal of militarists, is this type of person truly able to negotiate peace? Many people have stated that there's the open question of whether or not denuclearization means the same thing to North Koreans as it does to the Americans. The question that I ask, given that the United States waged a counter-revolutionary war, a war of asymmetrical aggression against Koreans, and that resulted in millions of Koreans dead. That's a Korean War that has never been concluded with a peace treaty. Is the United States actually capable of imagining what's necessary for peace? And so what you're seeing right now and what's being misrepresented in the media is actually North Korea declaring what it needs for peace.
Well, that's very well stated.
I'll say.
And again, for our audience, we're speaking with Hyun Lee and Dr. Christine Hong about the announcement that the DPRK leadership insists that the United States government stop and calculate what the consequences are of its policies and what impact it might have on the planned summit in Singapore between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. The fact that the DPRK has said stop and think, it indicates that North Korea is not coming to a summit on its knees, but it's treated as an act of bellicosity, as an act of belligerence, as a hostile act, as a threat, simply because the DPRK speaks like this. And Hyun, the first vice minister of foreign affairs, his statement, I want to read a couple sentences to you from it, because again, our audience needs to hear from the DPRK itself rather than through the filter of this biased, bigoted, corporate-owned media here. Here's what he said. But now, prior to the DPRK-US summit, unbridled remarks provoking the other side of dialogue are recklessly made in the United States, and I am totally disappointed as these constitute extremely unjust behavior. High-ranking officials of the White House and the Department of State, including Bolton, that's John Bolton, White House National Security Advisor, are letting loose the assertions of so-called Libya mode of nuclear abandonment, quote, complete verifiable and irreversible denuclearization, quote, total decommissioning of nuclear weapons, missiles, biochemical weapons, etc., close quote, while talking about the formula of abandoning nuclear weapons first, compensating afterwards. This is not an expression of intention to address the issue through dialogue. It is essentially a manifestation of awfully sinister move to impose on our dignified state the destiny of Libya or Iraq, which have been collapsed due to yielding to the whole of their countries to big powers. I cannot suppress indignation at such moves of the United States and harbor doubt about the U.S. sincerity for improved DPRK-U.S. relations through sound dialogue and negotiations. The world knows all too well that our country is neither Libya nor Iraq, which have met such a miserable fate. Hyun, those are not threatening words. Those are basically an appeal to reason, so to speak, by the North Korean leadership saying, look, if your intention by referencing now, right on the eve of the summit, the Libya model, and we all know Libya gave up its weapons of mass destruction, and it was John Bolton who was the overseer of that process. And then the United States, using NATO as the instrument, went to war against Libya, bombed it for months until its head of state was finally lynched in the streets. If for the U.S. to use this kind of language and this model, it is pure recklessness. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it is an appeal to reason, but that's assuming that, you know, the leadership in Washington is of rational mind, right? I mean, what we're seeing right now is exactly what the U.S. has done in past negotiations with North Korea. North Korea has come to the table in the past and said, we will give up our nuclear weapons if you also stop your nuclear threats and also normalize relations. But the U.S. totally ignores those demands and then says, oh, we will give you some economic incentives, just like Pompeo was recently on CBS. And he said, oh, if North Korea takes steps to denuclearize, the U.S. will offer business opportunities with American corporations. But this is not what North Korea is interested in. It's more interested in fundamental resolution of the conflict, of the Korean War that is ongoing. If anyone in Washington is listening, they should know that North Korea for decades has made clear what it wants, which is normalization and denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. So I think we need to break down what these things mean. So normalization means obviously establishing normal relations between the two countries, including trade, travel, embassies, normal lines of communication. This requires ending the Korean War, which means the main parties of the war that signed the armistice back in 1953, which are the U.S. and North Korea primarily, they need to declare an end to the war and replace the armistice with a peace treaty. The second thing, denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, it means getting rid of all things that pose a nuclear threat to the Korean Peninsula. So it's worthwhile to look at North Korea's statement back in 2016 that talks about removing U.S. nuclear threats on the Korean Peninsula. And it says, if the U.S. does the following, we will reciprocate in kind. Number one, all nuclear weapons of the United States and South Korea should be publicly disclosed. Two, all the nuclear weapons and their bases should be dismantled and verified in the eyes of the world. Three, the U.S. should ensure they will never again bring nuclear strike means to South Korea, which the U.S. has frequently deployed on the Korean Peninsula and its vicinity. Four, it should stop intimidating North Korea with nuclear weapons. And five, withdraw U.S. troops that hold the right to use nuclear weapons in South Korea. So, you know, we should be clear that North Korea is not offering to give up its nuclear weapons as a form of capitulation to maximum pressure. It's not going to ship out all of its nuclear weapons in exchange for just a pledge that the U.S. guarantees its security. You know, it wants to leverage its strength as a de facto nuclear weapon state to fundamentally resolve the longstanding conflict with the U.S. And North Korea has always talked about the principle of action for action, meaning both parties should take mutual steps toward denuclearization. So I think this is what North Korea is saying it wants for the upcoming Kim-Trump summit, and really the ball is in the U.S. court.
Christine, one of the narratives that we see, and it's we're seeing it increasingly clearly as each day ticks by here in the U.S. media, is that the North Koreans are coming to us, hat in hand, looking for some sort of an economic handout. Now, the North Koreans haven't said anything about an economic handout. I think this is probably insulting to them. Perhaps the idea is to humiliate them. But what they seem to want is respect and to be treated as a serious country. Am I misreading this? Am I missing something?
It tends to be that in the United States, most people perceive North Korea through a persistent fog of war and have absolutely no clarity about North Korea, its motivations, or really what it means to be on the receiving end of U.S. regime policy. You know, this unremitting policy for several decades. So the people in the United States do not understand what it means to be under that degree of existential threat. And so what's happened is North Korea, you know, it's basically been, it's no exaggeration to say that it's been between a rock and a hard place. And North Korea perceived that the only way that it could create room for maneuver was by taking to the nuclear path. And so it has taken to the nuclear path so that it could come to the negotiating table as an equal partner. And if North Korea hadn't taken to that path, quite frankly, we wouldn't even be having this discussion about the possibility of peace. So there's something very skewed in the way the media characterizes this, as though, as Ken was saying, crediting Trump's maximum pressure policy for the opening that we're seeing right now. The other thing, too, is, you know, there's something of that kind of notion of, you know, almost like a sort of shock doctrine sort of dimension to this, where the United States historically has destroyed places and seen the places that they've destroyed as opportunities for investment. Even though the United States destroyed North Korea completely during its bombing of North Korea several decades ago, it still has had a prospector's view toward that. And so Pompeo's language very much is state, I mean, his language, we should read it. He's basically saying that the only way that North Korea could have a quote-unquote bright future is if it takes to the neoliberal road. And what this discounts is the fact that the Korean people struggle against the division of their country has always also been a class struggle. And there are people also in South Korea, labor unions, et cetera, that are saying there has to be a workers' vision for peace.
Yeah, that will never come vis-a-vis a U.S. economic plan, certainly. Hyun, I mean, none of us have crystal balls. Christine Hong laid out a very convincing argument that the U.S. may not be structurally prepared or capable of actually having a peace deal on the Korean Peninsula because there's so many vested interests that are connected with the military-industrial complex who find a growing tension in Korea continuing the tension to be fundamentally important in terms of used as a justification or as a rationale. Donald Trump, on the other hand, seemed to want to go forward with this thing for whatever reasons, maybe an ego-invested reason, he wants to be the man or whatever. He seemed to be pretty flat-footed, unable to really quickly respond. The State Department seemed to be surprised by the DPRK's statement. Anyway, do you think down the road we're actually going to be having a summit?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Christine that all of those challenges are real. But, you know, I think North Korea actually has less to lose in this situation if it walks away from the summit, because it will keep its nuclear weapons to deter any acts of aggression from the United States. It's making progress in economic development. It will continue to improve relations with South Korea and other countries in the region. They're already talking about this railway project that is going to connect the railways of South Korea to North Korea to China, and that's going to be an economic boon for all parties. I think the United States, on the other hand, has more to lose if the summit doesn't go forward. Number one, if it allows North Korea to become a de facto nuclear power, what is going to stop Iran and other countries who don't agree with the U.S. from doing exactly the same thing, especially now that Trump has walked away from the Iran deal? That would completely shift the global balance of power against U.S. strategic interests. Number two, the U.S. military is overextended. It cannot win decisively in one region, let alone two. The Pentagon's the new defense strategy just about says that. The U.S. has no military option to resolve the North Korea nuclear issue. And I think if it did have that option, it would have already taken that. And three, Trump desperately needs a policy win before the midterm election. He has so many scandals on so many fronts. He needs this more than Kim Jong-un does. So I do think from the U.S. side, they will move forward to prepare for the summit. But, you know, as Kim Gae-gwan has already made clear in his statement yesterday, I think the ball is really in the U.S. court.
Dr. Christine Hong, your assessment, do you agree with Hyun Lee?
You know, I absolutely do agree with Hyun Lee. You know, basically with the two Koreas coming together, also live streaming that summit, what they basically broadcast to the world is that the Korean people are united in their desire for peace. And the United States, you know, should it, you know, commit, you know, to the war path that it's always been on, should it not actually support the prospect of peace, I mean, it's going to be very clear to the entire world, if it's not already, who the actual warmonger is, you know. So, you know, I do think that North Korea has really, in terms of strategy, it really does, to some degree, have the upper hand.
I agree, too. I think DPRK's strengthened its position considerably. Anyway, we're out of time. We're going to obviously keep following this as perhaps the most important or one of the two most important stories internationally. We've been joined from Philadelphia by Hyun Lee. Hyun is a member of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea, and she's a writer for zoominkorea.org. Go to zoominkorea.org to read her writings and the writings of others in the organization. And we've been joined from Santa Cruz, California by Dr. Christine Hong. She's an associate professor of critical race and ethnic studies at UC Santa Cruz, and she is a member of the Korea Policy Institute. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a brief break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our regular segment. It's every Wednesday called Beyond Nuclear with Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. You can read about his work and his writings and the work of his organization at beyondnuclear.org. We're also joined in studio by Nicole Rossell. She is a producer of this show and a Sputnik News analyst. Nicole and Kevin, welcome back.
Thanks.
Thanks so much.
You know, we talk every week about nuclear waste, nuclear energy, nuclear technology, nuclear weapons, all things nuclear. Kevin, the last 2 weeks, we've been talking to you from New Mexico. I can tell you have a cold.
Yes.
So I know you've been an active person. What's going on in New Mexico now?
Well, we're still fighting this high-level radioactive waste dump where all of the commercial fuel, irradiated nuclear fuel from the entire country, more than 100 reactors, would be parked out in southeastern New Mexico. The company is called Holtec International. And unfortunately, the local governments, Eddy County, Lee County, the towns of Hobbs and Carlsbad, are blinded by radioactive dollar signs. And we've had some really good news. For one thing, about a week ago, we sent a letter to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and we said that 60 days for public comment on environmental scoping is not long enough. We demand 180 days more. They didn't give us that, but they very quickly, within a couple days, last Friday, they gave us 60 additional days, and we will put that to good use. We've already collected thousands of signatures, especially in New Mexico, but other places too. The comments are rolling into the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And in addition to that, the two U.S. senators from New Mexico, who are both Democrats, Udall and Heinrich, had demanded northern New Mexico hearings, which had been denied thus far. All the hearings were either in southeast New Mexico. It's a big state. You know, it's a five-hour drive from Albuquerque down to that area. And a lot of folks made that drive. Well, now they're going to have an Albuquerque hearing early next week. They're going to have a Gallup hearing, which is in uranium mining country out in the northwest of the state, Pueblo Indian territory. So they're gonna hear some things from folks out there who've been suffering from nuclear activities for a long time.
I want to talk about the dollar signs that might be in people's eyes and just think, help everybody sort of think that through. Like, if you came to a family and said, guess what, we're gonna put nuclear radioactive waste in your backyard or close by, but we're gonna pay you for it. Anybody who already has any kind of financial security would say, no, we're going to die, or we could die. Our children could be poisoned. This poisoning will go on for not just decades, but who knows how long into the sort of unforeseeable future. They would say, absolutely not. What's the quid pro quo here that would make any government agency think in New Mexico, or any political leader, think, yeah, let's bring radioactive waste from all over the country and park it here?
Well, one of my colleagues is Acoma Pueblo Indian, and he's been fighting uranium mining for many decades. I believe it started in the 1950s out there. And so they're just downwind and maybe even downstream from massive uranium mining aftermath that's still there, hasn't been cleaned up, is contaminating groundwater. Water is so precious out there. So Patuch Gilbert says that New Mexico is addicted to nuclear money. And of course, it began with Los Alamos in like 1943. And now you've got Los Alamos Nuclear Lab, you've got Sandia Nuclear Lab in Albuquerque, the two largest employers in the state. In addition to that, you have the history of the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, which is military plutonium disposal. And it's only about a dozen miles from this targeted Holtec site. And so when you start adding it all up, it is an addiction to nuclear money. And some people don't get any of that. The Acoma Pueblo doesn't get any of that money. It's the nuclear establishment that gets that money. And they have, you know, employed some people in southeast New Mexico at the WIP dump. Those were some of the people who spoke in favor of this new proposal. But we outnumbered them in their company town at the microphone. We had, I can't remember the exact numbers, but we beat them that night. And if you add it all up, we had over 100 speakers in the first four hearings. They had something like 40. So we're beating them at the microphone, even in their home turf.
Let's just take a quick detour, because what you just talked about in terms of the history of New Mexico's addiction to nuclear power or nuclear energy or nuclear weapons, it started in 1943, you said, at Los Alamos. That would be 75 years ago. I don't think most people in the country know even what Los Alamos is. Just help them understand, help us understand.
Well, most ironically, the scientific lead of the Manhattan Project to develop nuclear weapons in World War II was Robert Oppenheimer. And the irony is that as a child, as a teenager, he went out to New Mexico. I think it was because he had asthma and needed fresh air. So his doctors sent him out there. That's my understanding. So when it came time as an adult to lead the Manhattan Project scientifically and technologically, he knew just the place to do it. Very secluded, very remote. They could impose maximum security. He chose the place that had healed him as a youngster to poison with radioactivity ever since. There's massive contamination at Los Alamos. The Pueblo Indians, again, the Jemez Pueblo, for example, are immediately next door to Los Alamos, the Santa Clara Pueblo. So they really built that nuclear weapons laboratory on top of sacred land near the communities of the Pueblo Indians. There were, of course, Hispanics there. And those were the people who got the dirtiest jobs, even in the 40s, radioactive waste handling jobs. And that same history of nuclear colonialism, as my colleague Leona Morgan has put it in the context of Holtec, she has, you know, said that she is Diné from that same area up in northwest New Mexico. They've suffered tremendously, not only the Pueblo, but the Navajo Diné. And she says nuclear colonialism began here in the United States, and it's still going very strong in this state.
Yeah, nuclear colonialism. I like the phrase, and I think it captures what's actually gone on. So this was to make the atomic bomb. Los Alamos was to an emergency national mobilization. Like when the government was confronted with a national emergency, it could pool all of its scientific resources, its engineering resources, its technological resources to do something. And that something was to build this bomb that was unlike any other weapon in world history. And as soon as the U.S. had that weapon, they used it. And at that time, the United States had a monopoly on this technology. It was the only country that had nuclear weapons. But very quickly, the Soviet Union caught up, and thus the arms race was underway. And we entered the nuclear era. And I saw somewhere, and I know we have other stories we want to talk about, but I saw somewhere that since 1943, the United States has spent something like $7 or $8 trillion on nuclear weapons. And again, the only time nuclear weapons have been used was those two times in August 1945, but $7 trillion or $10 trillion, I don't know the number, you do. That's a lot of money. You could do a lot of things with something like that.
Well, that figure comes from a book called The Nuclear Audit from 1996. So it's a 20-year-old figure, 22 years old. And, you know, just adjust for inflation, and you take the $7.5 trillion up much higher. But they've spent a lot of money since, you know, the last 22 years. And as we've talked about in previous episodes, they have a $1 trillion nuclear modernization plan in the works. It'll take some 30 years to spend that much money, but they're hot at it. I mean, there's appropriations bills passing on the Hill right now with direct relevance to these numbers. So they've got new weapons designs. They've got plutonium production at both Los Alamos, New Mexico, but also now at Savannah River Site, South Carolina. That's a new development. They want to make weapons-grade plutonium and put it in weapons in South Carolina. So they are, it's a gravy train.
And it seems, too, like this is all ad hoc. Even though we've been doing this for decades now, closing in on a century, really, almost, it's like they haven't really thought out a strategy. They have these facilities in New Mexico and Nevada and Texas and now maybe North Carolina or South Carolina, and they're just spread out all over the country. It's like no thought went into, if we're going to do this, how do we make it work? How do we keep it as clean as possible and as safe as possible? Nobody ever asked those questions.
Well, there's another development in South Carolina, mixed oxide plutonium fuel fabrication facility. This is excess military plutonium, of which both the United States and Russia have tens of tons. You only need a few pounds to make a nuclear warhead. It's a really bad thing to have this stuff laying around. So one of the ideas, it was a really bad idea, we fought this for decades because it was such a bad idea, was to take that excess plutonium and make it into reactor fuel to burn as fuel in commercial atomic reactors for electricity production. Super expensive, would create a police state in this country because now you have to guard this commercialized plutonium as it travels the highways and byways and is stored at reactor sites, which have infamously bad security. Mm-hmm. So just in the last few days, Energy Secretary Rick Perry did something that makes it look like they're going to kill that mixed oxide plutonium fuel fabrication facility in South Carolina, where they've already spent like $5 billion. But the thing is, if they keep going with this white elephant down there, they're going to spend $55 billion on this plutonium disposition plan. And so the latest, here's that connection between South Carolina and New Mexico, the latest cheaper plan for half the cost is to treat the plutonium as a deadly waste, as we've been pointing out for this last 25 years, and dispose of it as a waste. And where they want to do that, unfortunately for Southeast New Mexico, is at the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, which is a facility. It's underground, 2,000 feet, for plutonium military waste disposal. A question that arises to my mind, is there space? Because they lost a fair chunk of their facility in 2014 to an atmospheric environmental plutonium release that was supposed to be impossible, but they had a barrel burst in the underground from Los Alamos. And the joke is that it had to do with kitty litter, actually. They put kitty litter in a barrel of toxic and radioactive waste to absorb liquid. That's rational. But a typo led to inorganic, which means clay-based, using organic kitty litter, which is plant-based, and that fueled the fire and the chemical reaction. They blew the lid on a barrel, and that one barrel burst, there's hundreds of thousands of barrels down there, cost $2 billion to recover from and made parts of the facility unusable because people
forever.
Have to. Well, the cost to clean it up would be so astronomical that it'd be cheaper just to figure out something else than try to clean it up. So, and it's created real risks for the workers who now have to take very careful precautions. They used to be able to go down in clothing without respiratory protection. Now they got to wear triple layer suits and also have severe respiratory protection. Because if you breathe in plutonium, even a small amount, you could induce lung cancer.
This seems like such a theme to me that there are so many facilities and so many parts of the process in nuclear use and creation where the creators of these things assume that there won't be any risk. They assume that the humans will be perfect, that there won't be any problems, that there will never be any errors. And if that's the case, then maybe things could be relatively safe-ish. But there's always human error. There's always the typos. There's always the, you know, contractor who accidentally leaves a brick or a log in, you know, the creation of some sort of cask. Like there's always an error and that will always lead to more problems.
Oh, you wouldn't believe some of the stuff that's going on. So last summer, I believe it was, the Center for Responsive Politics did a whole series, a half dozen major articles on major risky errors that have been made at each of these nuclear weapons facilities, Los Alamos, Savannah River Site, where especially the workforce who's in the nearest proximity to these deadly materials, but it was through their own misbehavior too. Not only the work, the lower level workers, but the management above. And they came darn close to having inadvertent nuclear criticalities at Los Alamos. That had to do with the workers in this plutonium separation and fuel fabrication lab, and this is nuclear weapons related work. They were so proud of their work that they tried to put all their work into one frame for a photograph, literally just taking a selfie of their plutonium fuel that they had fabricated. And they came really darn close to creating a critical mass that would have killed them instantly. And that's happened in the past. It's happened at Los Alamos a couple times, but that was way back in like 44 and 46. You'd think they'd learn from that stuff, and they didn't. They came really darn close in recent years.
I mean, the thing is, accidents always do happen.
Right.
That's part of the foundational issue, though, with nuclear technology is that, yes, weird, ironic things, organic versus inorganic, cat litter, you know, sets off a barrel explosion, et cetera, et cetera. But when we have little problems with little things, we just kind of live with it. We roll with it. But these are not little things, because the problem of any accident is so outsized because of the fundamental nature of the technology itself. It's foundational.
But we're human beings. We know there will be errors.
We know there will be errors. And in this realm, more than almost any other realm in life, in science, in society, anywhere, the outcome from a mistake is so great.
It's catastrophic.
It's almost inherently catastrophic.
Well, you know, one other nuclear waste dump we should talk about this week is there was a big house and a big U.S. House vote last Thursday. And the dump that they're after in the House, especially, we talked about New Mexico, is in Nevada. It's the Yucca Mountain dump site. And it's been a proposal for 30 plus years in this country. It's a bad site. It's an earthquake zone. It's a volcanic zone. It's going to leak massively into the groundwater if they ever bury nuclear waste there. And the House just voted yet again. They used to call it Screw Nevada. That was in 1987 when Nevada got singled out for this dump. It's for commercial high-level nuclear waste. And they just voted last Thursday by a vote of 340 to 74 to go forward with this thing, only to make it much worse. Instead of a 70,000-ton limit, they want to up it to 110,000. And they want to gut the regulations. They want to gut the due process at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to look at the risks, to decide if it's even a good idea. And so now that fight goes to the U.S. Senate. But what I was going to say was, when you're talking about people make mistakes, things aren't perfect, things could go wrong, it's that transportation issue that, you know, we work hard to try to wake the whole country up to. So in the case of Yucca, with 70,000 metric tons, that's current law. They haven't changed the law yet, but they're one step closer. You're going to have 44 states impacted by these trucks, trains, and then if you add the barges, that's going to be more than 44 states. And you're taking tremendous risks. You're moving this stuff. One example is Chicago, south side of Chicago, 40% of all the shipments out to Yucca would pass through South Chicago. And the safety risks of a severe accident or an intentional attack on these containers that aren't designed for anti-tank missiles, I mean, they do have thick radiation shielding. That's to try to keep in most of the gamma radiation and the neutron radiation. And there's another risk is these things are mobile X-ray machines that can't be turned off, rolling through communities. They're given off a gamma and neutron dose. The closer you are, the worse it is. But people that live along those routes and wear the train tracks many times, you know, it's changing now. Right in D.C., you've got condos, high-end condos next to train tracks. But in lots of parts of the country, it's low-income communities, it's people of color communities. They're going to have a risk even if nothing goes wrong. But if something does go wrong, it could be. Our slogan is mobile Chernobyl or floating Fukushimas or dirty bombs on wheels. And that's the part of this story that those 340 members of Congress in the House who just voted for this thing, many of them don't have waste in their districts, but it's going to come through their districts on trucks and trains and maybe barges. They have no clue. As hard as we work to try to alert them to this, apparently they didn't get the memo because they voted the wrong way.
You think they don't listen to Beyond Nuclear every Wednesday on Loud and Clear between 4 and 6 p.m.?
It might be good for their, you know, constituents.
Well, they might listen to it.
Yeah.
Try to, like, learn about the enemy that's trying to, like, actually stop disasters from happening.
Well, we did. I started work in D.C. back in 1999. And in 2009, American University, the Investigative Reporting Workshop, Judy Pasternak, who wrote a book about Navajo uranium mining aftermath called Yellow Dirt, with a skull and crossbones on the cover, they did a study up at American University. How big is the nuclear power lobby in the United States? And the time period was funny for me because that was how long I'd been in D.C., 1999 to 2009. It just happened to be the time period they looked at. And their figures were $64.5 million in campaign contributions. And then the lobbying figure was what floored me. It was about $650 million in a 10-year period. And I did the math, and it was $1.25 million per week. And I was like, I knew what that felt like. I didn't know what the figure was, but I knew what we were up against in that decade. And one of the biggest coveted goals of the nuclear power lobby was the Yucca Mountain dump at that time. But Senator Harry Reid of Nevada had devoted his political career to stopping that dump. They messed with the wrong rookie senator back in 1987 on Screw Nevada. They never saw Vegas growing as big as it got. They never saw a Nevada senator becoming Senate Majority Leader. And politically, he was able to block it. And now it's back. They're trying hard. Just yesterday, the House Energy and Water Appropriations approved a massive increase in Yucca Mountain funding. So that fight is back on.
Let's go to nuclear weapons for a moment, because we have the U.S. has exited the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. You have Iran right now in Europe. The Iranian foreign minister meeting with the head of the EU, that EU is committed to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, meeting with British and French and German officials. It's unclear what Iran will do. The Europeans are now trying to say to the Iranians, look, we'll give you financial incentives, we'll shield some of our commercial and banking transactions so that we won't be punished by the U.S. as third-party players doing business with a now more sanctioned Iran. But bottom line is Europe won't, I think, give up the American market for an Iranian market for purely business purposes. And so it's possible that Iran will do what it said it could do, which is to leave the agreement. What will it mean for Iran to leave the agreement? What would they do? What would be lost from the point of view of the what's in the treaty or the agreement now that would be undone?
Well, I mean, if they returned to the nuclear activities that were prohibited for a 15-year time period, they could very quickly restart their uranium enrichment program. And it could take place within easily within months. And the estimate back when the agreement was hammered out a couple, 3 years ago was that Iran was a year away from nuclear weaponry in terms of having enough weapons-grade, highly enriched uranium from these centrifuges. So you can see that it's a very short fuse to getting a nuclear weapon, and both the U.S. Trump administration and the Netanyahu administration in Israel have said they won't get one. It ain't happening. So what that means is war. I mean, that's the only way to stop such a short fuse in that amount of time. That's what the Obama administration decided was worth trying to prevent with this agreement, as did most of the, you know, major powers of Western Europe and Russia and China. So that was, you know, very explicitly to try to prevent a war against Iran or with Iran. And so Trump has partially undone that preventative agreement. So that's kind of the danger. I mean, there's certain things I think that would take much longer. If Iran wanted a plutonium pathway to the bomb, I don't know how far along they are in dismantling that plutonium production reactor that they had, but I think they took immediate action. That's why the International Atomic Energy Agency has said they're in full compliance with the agreements. And granted, you know, that 15-year time period would eventually elapse, but the hope of the Obama administration, you know, the writing on the wall was maybe we can reach some further agreement in the next 15 years through confidence building of this agreement, you know. And that's where Trump was so absurd, was like, oh, they still have the ability to make nuclear weapons. Yeah, but it's 15 years away. And if they break the agreement before then, that's when they're in the hot seat and they're going to have the, you know, essentially the rest of the world against them. Now Trump has scrambled all of that. And, you know, strangely, there are hardline elements in Iran who very much are gleeful about this split between the United States and Europe. That's something that the hardline in Iran couldn't have dreamed of before, and now they have it.
Back in, I think it was 1981, Israel destroyed the Iraqi nuclear facility with a bombing attack. One, is it possible that Israel or others could trying to do the same to Iran? And if so, what would be the impact of that? In other words, where they wouldn't necessarily start a full-out major war with Iran, but carry out surgical military strikes against these nuclear facilities?
Well, some of them are bunkered. They're underground. And so conventional armaments probably can't penetrate that deep. And that was something we discussed on a previous interview, was under Bush Cheney, there was a plan to detonate a 700-ton explosive in the Nevada desert. It was conventional explosives, but they were doing experiments on how big of a nuclear blast would we need, or how small of a nuclear blast would we need to take out those bunkered Iranian nuclear facilities. And we have armaments in our arsenal, the B-61, for one, that you can dial down very low. And so they were trying to figure out how many hundreds of tons of TNT, essentially, would it take? And we'll dial the B-61 down to that, and we'll be ready to go against Iran. And so, you know, Israel has a nuclear arsenal. So that's all very scary stuff, and Iran does not. And so sometimes the strategy of the nuclear firecracker boys is, well, you want to take out your enemy before they get one, you know, and Trump has been saying things like that about North Korea, bloody nose strategy. We'll only take out the nuclear facilities, as if the other side, I mean, that can escalate kind of quickly. And North Korea has thousands of artillery howitzers aimed at Seoul, South Korea. So even if you take out the nuclear facilities, if North Korea chooses to retaliate, you're talking hundreds of thousands or millions of casualties.
We have right now also the DPRK, North Korea, saying that they may or may not be going forward with the summit with Donald Trump scheduled for Singapore on June 12th because, one, the U.S. is carrying out war exercises off their shore with B-52 bombers, and also because Bolton, the new national security advisor, has said, let's use Libya as a model for the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. That doesn't seem that attractive to North Korea because of what actually happened in Libya. Just talk about that, if you would, real quick. We have about 3 minutes left.
Well, Gaddafi ended up dead in the rebellion against his regime. And, you know, the West took part in that. The West provided the air cover, at the very least, for the armed rebellion against Gaddafi's regime. And that was after these agreements were made that Gaddafi would give up weapons of mass destruction.
I mean, in your opinion, this is speculation, of course, but why would Bolton be citing Libya as the model?
I don't really know.
It has to be a message, right? It has to be a message that we're not serious about you guys being a part of the international community. We're going to demand that you do this. And then even after you do it, we're still going to implement regime change. I mean, that's what it seems like to me.
If there was some other reason, the North Koreans will only interpret it as that. I mean,
right.
It really feels like a section of the Trump administration and certainly of the establishment, whatever that means in Washington, actually doesn't want a deal with North Korea, even if it means denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, because that would legitimize the government, which the U.S. seems committed to carrying out regime change. Like, in other words, the nuclear menace suddenly becomes less of an issue, just like with Trump and Iran. Like, they've complied, but it doesn't matter because the real goal for Trump is to overthrow their government.
Like, they're political footballs, these issues.
Yeah. And then how do you come to an agreement with the United States if, you know, the next year, the same president or a different president says, oh, we've changed our minds.
And that was an amazing thing about Gaddafi in Libya was, you know, there's a famous photograph of Sarkozy of France shaking hands with Gaddafi. So they were entering into this deal with the devil, but then they broke the deal, you know, very suddenly. And countries like North Korea probably pay attention to things like that.
Meanwhile, all of the residents of Korea and of Iran are, you know, completely under sanction and their economy is dwindling and doing poorly. I mean, it's just, yeah, it's insane.
Yeah. I mean, I think for some parts of the certain what are called the principalists in Iran, they're making the argument that because Obama before Trump and then Trump too imposed more sanctions on Iran, no matter what, Iran wasn't even deriving the benefits that they thought they would receive from the easing or lifting of sanctions. So the incentive for an agreement seems to just be vanishing. Anyway, 30 seconds left. Your words.
I always go back to the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony last December, where the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons warned that if we don't get rid of these things, they're going to get rid of us. Those are the risks we're running in a place like North Korea, which is now nuclear armed. And you've got, you know, that nightmare scenario of Israel is nuclear armed, trying to prevent Iran from becoming nuclear armed. So if the worst happens, we could alter the atmosphere of the earth. And lots of people, I mean, billions would die of famine if these weapons are used because the sun's going to be blotted out.
All right, we're going to leave it there. A sort of a bleak message.
Pretty grim.
But nonetheless, an important message because that's actually what's going on right now. Anyway, we've been joined in studio by Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. You can read his writings and find out about the group at beyondnuclear.org. Kevin joins us every Wednesday in this segment called Beyond Nuclear. Kevin, we'll see you next week.
Thank you so much.
And for our audience, you're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.